Well, welcome. My name is John Adams. I'm the chairman of the Foundation for Law, Justice, and Society, affiliated here in Oxford with the Center for Social Legal Studies and Wolfson College. The Foundation is committed to promoting the understanding of the role that law plays in society. We have projects going on such as the analysis of the role of courts in determining public policy, and China assessing the legal system and its economic development. Tonight we're commencing a third project, the Social Contract Revisited, or the Social Contract in the 21st Century. Martin Wolf recently wrote a commentary in the Financial Times entitled, Why America Will Need Some Elements of a Welfare State. He expressed a concern that globalization, among other things, was causing disequilibrium in wealthy countries, such as the United States, where the concepts of equal opportunity, individual responsibility, and state rights and benefits are being questioned. He finished his article by saying, I'm not suggesting that the United States should embrace Europe's interventionist follies, but without more generous government finance services, the United States may be unable to maintain a dynamic, internationally open, and socially mobile society. That may seem a paradox, Wolf says, but it's not. This comment raises just one of many questions that need to be addressed, if not fully answered, if institutions, government, and individuals are going to accept their social responsibilities. To open this discussion, we are both pleased and honored to have Professor Lord Raymond Plant give an address called Contract, Obligation, Rights, and Reciprocity in the New Modern Welfare State. Lord Plant is a well-regarded political philosopher focusing on social and political rights. Formerly, he was the master of St. Catherine's College here in Oxford, and currently he's a law professor and dean of the law faculty at King's College, London. He is a life peer and active member of the House of Lords and a spokesman for the Labour Party. Lord Plant.
Well, thank you for the introduction. I think I should say, since I'm about to give a talk, I'm not actually a spokesman for the Labour Party. I sit on the Labour benches, but I wouldn't like anything that I say to be thought to represent Labour Party policy, which may well be in a process of flux anyway with the change of Prime Minister on the horizon. John also said that afterwards there will be a question and answer session. Well, there'll certainly, no doubt, be a question session. I'm not too sure about the answers, but we'll no doubt see as time goes on. I think in a session like this, sort of starting a conference, getting a discussion of a theme underway, my job really is to be sort of rather general and to raise questions and to try to focus attention on at least some of what seem to me to be the main issues, rather than pursuing some very narrow issue in all its depth and focus. So that's what I intend to do. And one way of trying to start what is actually a rather vast topic is to say that there are at least two, seems to me anyway, two sorts of contractarian approaches, or two ways of looking at the role of contract in relation to the welfare state. First of all, there's what you might call a comprehensive approach, utilizing contractual ideas to justify this or that model of welfare. in much the same way as it's been used by political theorists over a large number of years, that the contractual method is a way of focusing on and giving a way of resolving issues of collective choice. And then secondly, there's a much less ambitious role for thinking about contract that is in the context of the link between particular elements of the welfare state, interest, so trying to justify whether there should be a welfare state, and if so, what sort it should be through a comprehensive approach, just looking at particular kinds of things and how far contract can illuminate questions in a much more specific way. I mean, the obvious case that I'm thinking about is the relationship between rights and obligations, or benefits and obligations, that kind of thing, the receipt of benefits and the discharge of obligations. Now, that more specific role for contract can in turn perhaps be justified by invoking the more comprehensive contractual idea. But I think it's useful just in terms of getting started in trying to get a handle on this rather large topic, to just to distinguish between those two things. So I want to start really with talking about social contract in the more comprehensive sense, and then come down, as my talk goes on, to talk about it in the more specific sense that I've mentioned. So in the comprehensive sense, the social contract is sort of sets out a mechanism for choosing between models of political order and political institutions at a basic level, usually historically at a constitutional level. And given that link between contract and the idea of providing a sort of legitimate basis for constitutional arrangement, some people might say, well, right at the beginning, therefore, contract in this comprehensive sense is irrelevant because welfare provision is a matter of policy. It's not a matter of basic constitutional arrangements. But I think this is possibly a rather short-sighted approach, because it seems to me that the welfare state and the questions raised by the welfare state do raise pretty basic questions about political organisation. For example, the scope of the state, the nature of the obligations of citizens to one another, whether they're negative or positive, or can also be positive, the implications of reciprocity, the relationship between entitlements and rights and obligations, the relationship between welfare and justice, both social justice in terms of the distribution of resources and other aspects of justice in terms, for example, of the rule of law and the use of discretionary power. Not to be overlooked, it seems to me, the relationship between the state and civil society, the voluntary sector, for example, charities or public enterprise companies, social enterprise companies, and so forth. So it does seem to me that thinking about very particular aspects of the welfare state does nevertheless raise some quite large questions about political organisation, and I don't think you can just say that, well, because welfare is a matter of policy, therefore contractual ideas in the comprehensive sense that I mentioned are not relevant. I don't think that's so. So I don't think there's an argument of principle for placing welfare issues outside the comprehensive idea of contract. It's more a question of whether, when we look at detailed issues in relation to the welfare state, the idea of a comprehensive contract is useful or salient for trying to think through those issues. And I want to try and say a bit about that. And I want to do this by outlining in broad and general terms some of the models of welfare, the contending models of welfare, between which choices have to be made before moving on to see how far contractual ideas will help us with those sorts of decisions between different and contending models. And in looking at those different models, which I'll go into in a moment, looking at those different models, I think that we need to consider the fact that at the heart of those models are claims which are quite difficult to place as between what you might call the normative and the empirical. I'll give examples of these as we go on. But clearly, any kind of contractual model is going to be having to operate with information of one sort or another. And I think a lot of the information used in the contractual models drawn from different sort of positions on welfare are an interesting amalgam very often of normative claims and empirical claims, many of which seem to me to be quite difficult to test and therefore, in a sense, quite difficult for the models, any contractual model, to deal with effectively. So in the case of normative claims, for example, I mean those that are perhaps clearly normative as opposed to empirical, that the model will have to have resources to interpret and rank different sorts of normative claims as they enter or as they are thrown up by different models of the welfare state. So it's quite it's likely that these different models will involve claims to do, for example, with justice, with needs, with freedom, with equality, with welfare itself, with the rule of law, and so on. What demands does the need to be able to produce an arbitration procedure to order these kinds of values? What kinds of demands does that make on the model? It's very difficult to see how far you can get in thinking about different types of welfare state without having some kind of view about the relevance and salience of the values that I mentioned, justice, needs, freedom, equality, welfare, the rule of law, and so forth. And then secondly, alongside those normative issues, ranking those values in some way, in some kind of authoritative way, perhaps via the use of a contractual model. Alongside that, there's the use of straightforwardly empirical claims about the effects of different welfare forms of provision. I mean, for example, claims about dependency and so forth. And the way in which welfare, in some ways in which it's delivered, sort of atomizes society and these sorts of things. And there's obviously a lot of empirical evidence about these sorts of issues. So there are both what you might call straightforward normative questions and straightforward empirical questions, but there are also questions which involve a rather unholy mixture of both of these things, which I want to perhaps focus on most as the talk goes on. And I'm intrigued as to how contractual models can deal with rather hybrid kinds of information, as it were, normative issues which are interlocked with empirical claims. On the empirical side of the argument, even assuming for the moment that there are straightforward empirical claims being made which don't raise normative issues, that there are still some interesting questions here for contractual theories. In his book, A Theory of Justice, when Rawls argues that the contracting parties behind the veil of ignorance would know certain rather general things. They will know general things about human psychology, and they will know general things about the organisation of human society. So how far do the empirical claims that are made, for example, in different welfare models, let's say, and I'm not going into these at the moment, but let's say about welfare dependency or the atomizing effects of certain kinds of welfare delivery programs, how far can they be regarded as part of the Rawlsian general knowledge, as it were, that's known behind the veil of ignorance? And whether you're a Rawlsian or not, I mean, any kind of contractual theory is going to have to make use of some kinds of general information. So how far is this? How far are the empirical claims made in different welfare models to be regarded as part of this sort of general information that can be used in a kind of contractarian argument of this comprehensive sort? And secondly, the second sort of Rawlsian point is that if these claims, these empirical claims, are supposed to be of this general sort, then they will also form part of the sort of considered judgments of the society that the contract model is supposed to be systematizing, making coherent and illuminating. Because there couldn't be, given Rawls's reflexive equilibrium method, there couldn't be a big disjunction between the general knowledge that the contracting parties have, both about human psychology and about society. There couldn't be a big disjunction between that knowledge and the considered judgment of citizens in the society which the contractual model is supposed to be systematizing the considered judgments of. So, is there something in the different welfare models that could be claimed to be part of a sort of shared set of considered judgments which are relatively uncontroversial? And if not, if those judgments are highly controversial, for example, judgments about welfare dependency, let's say, how do we then get around the kind of Rawlsian problem of putting behind the veil of ignorance a set of general propositions about psychology and society, and it's very difficult to see how you can get away from that. How do you put those behind the veil of ignorance so that they can be used in a contractarian way while at the same time accepting perhaps that they are highly controversial in terms of people's considered moral judgments in the sense that many people might disagree with them? So, having said that by way of preamble, let's move to a brief and broad account of a number of different approaches to welfare. I'm not making any claims of my own about these different accounts, and I'm not at all claiming that they're exhaustive. Only I want to use them to illustrate some of the deep difficulties, it seems to me, in utilising contractual reasoning to resolve the differences between these different models. And if we think about it as a bit of a spectrum for the moment, I mean, at one end of the spectrum might be a sort of Nozickian approach to these sorts of issues, that there is no morally legitimate case in terms of justice for state-provided welfare at all, that welfare should be a private matter between individuals or individuals and voluntary organisations, from each as they choose, to each as they are chosen, as Nozick pithily puts it. Or in the same kind of ballpark, but not remotely a similar kind of structure of argument, Hayek's view that equally accepting that there is no case in terms of social justice for a welfare state, but nevertheless a limited, minimalist kind of welfare state can be given some kind of, well, what to me is extremely obscure justification in the Constitution of Liberty, but let's say it's a kind of pragmatic justification if it can be dignified by being given a sort of label like that. So, I mean, that's a, that those two views are relatively well known, and I go into the issues that they raise in a moment. Then secondly, sort of moving across the spectrum a bit, might be an insurance-based approach that entitlements to benefits of various sorts arise in a either explicitly contractual way, perhaps through forms of private insurance, or perhaps in a more quasi-contractual way via state forms of insurance, which was very much the Beveridge principle here in the United Kingdom in the Lord Beveridge's report. Apart from those on national assistance, the assumption was that welfare would arise through insurance types of arrangements. And then, moving across the spectrum a bit further, citizenship-based approaches to welfare. Of these, there are quite a number, some of which overlap, some of which are incompatible. One might be a common needs approach, that common needs give rise to a recognition for a case for common provision. Secondly, that welfare might be seen as a basic right of citizenship, justified on the basis of common membership of a political community. That welfare might be seen in terms of a citizen's right to a basic income, rather than perhaps a range of benefits in kind of one sort or another. And incidentally, this is, I think, a very coming idea in Europe. I was reading on the train coming down this week's edition of Die Zeit, which isn't given to talking about political theory very often, but in the Wirtschaft section of Die Zeit this week, there's a whole sort of thing on basic income and how both the left and the right in Germany, both in terms of think tanks but also practical politicians, are all seeking to embrace the issue of basic income. There's a big difference about how big the income should be. It looks to be between 800 and 1,500 euros. But of course, as Die Zeit makes clear, one of the big issues in that debate is what kinds of obligations, if any, should the citizen in receipt of a basic income discharge as a condition for receiving it? Should it be a basic income paid unconditionally as a badge of citizenship, or should it be a basic income paid only if you are discharging some kind of concomitant obligation, and if so, what sort of obligation? Which then pushes us further across the spectrum towards a more obligation-based view of welfare, away from this sort of citizenship entitlement approach. So we've got a number of different models here, which are not obviously compatible with one another. And if contract, in the comprehensive sense, is going to be a very illuminating tool for thinking about these things, then there ought to be a way of utilising contractarian ideas for arbitrating, as it were, between these rather different and contending but equally basic views of how political organisations should work to meet the needs or not of the citizens that comprise them. Now, obviously, I can't give a detailed examination of all these different approaches, but I just want to talk about three or four, in fact, I think five, quite deep issues, it seems to me, that are raised by these different models. First of all, if we look at the kind of new right model, as it might be called, the libertarian end of liberalism, as it were, which I mentioned in relation to Nozick and Hayek. The important thing here, it seems to me, there are lots of important things, but one thing that Nozick and Hayek have in common, which I've mentioned, is that they both dispute the claim that the welfare state is to be seen as an instrument of social justice. And this raises the question of how are we to determine, as it were, what is the end goal or purpose of something like the welfare state? Is it an instrument of social justice? Or, if not, how are we to understand it? Is it about the relief of poverty in a way that is to be understood as distinctly different from a concern with social justice and so forth? Is there a kind of dominant end in terms of how we are to understand the welfare state? Now, for Rawls, justice is the first virtue of institutions. And given that, he then uses a contractual model to try to figure out what justice requires. But the claim that justice is the first virtue of institutions is not itself, as it were, put into the contract. I mean, this is a pre-contractual judgment that is the first virtue of institutions. And he argues for that in those sections of A Theory of Justice to do with the circumstances of justice, what he calls the circumstances of justice, and in his critique of the system of natural liberty. The point I'm trying to make by saying that is how are we to distinguish in a contractual model between what is, as it were, to be regarded as given in a pre-contractual way, like for Rawls, justice is the first virtue of institutions, and then you have a contractarian sort of deliberation about what justice in that sense requires. And what would other people say about that? I mean, because some people might want to say, what is the aim, goal, or purpose of institutions, including the welfare state, should itself be part of the contractual deliberation, as it were. It's quite a subtle issue, it seems to me, but it does seem to me to be really important, because for someone like Nozick or Hayek, certainly they would not accept that social justice has any role as a virtue in institutions. And is that fundamental question about what is the dominant end of an institutional setup, is that to be resolved pre-contractually, or is it itself to be part of the contractual deliberation? That seems to me to be a pretty basic question to start with. And yet a lot would follow from that, because if you thought that social justice was not part of the end goal or purpose of the welfare state, then how you then go on to interpret issues like equality and liberty and the balance between those would be fundamentally influenced by what sort of view you had about social justice as the kind of fundamental value in all of this. Well, it's not just that. I mean, that seems to me an important point to do with how we conceive the scope and range and content, really, of contractarian reasoning. But that there's more to it than that, in the sense that both in Nozick and Hayek, and this is a point that's brought out very well in the contrast with Rawls, there is this interesting mixture in all three of them of normative and empirical claims, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. So, for example, on a kind of Hayekian view or a Nozickian view, we bear no collective responsibility for the outcomes of market behaviour, so long as that market behaviour is undertaken in a non-coercive way, that buying and selling in the context of a set of negative rights, of mutual non-coercion, produces outcomes that are, in principle, fair and legitimate, and we bear no collective responsibility for the poverty that some people may experience as the result of those free exchanges. Now, there, I mean, I'm not arguing for or against this view, but there I think you can see, if you start unpicking all of that, how you get this kind of interpenetration of both the normative and the empirical claims that, for example, claims that market outcomes are not intended, they're not foreseeable, that questions about, which are sort of empirical questions, but questions about the scope and character and enforceability of negative rights are much more normative kinds of questions, and so on. So given the interpenetration of both the normative and the empirical, in that kind of case for saying, well, we don't have to have state provision for welfare because we don't bear collective responsibility, we are getting this kind of interpenetration of the normative and the empirical that, that contractarian theories will have to deal with if they're going to be in a position to resolve some of these questions. But equally, with Rawls, there would be a kind of Rawlsian response to that kind of view of markets would also reveal the same kind of penetration, for example, that we can justify the idea of collective responsibility because the outcomes of markets are, in general terms, foreseeable, namely that those who enter the market with least will leave it with least. It may not be the case with absolutely everybody, but by and large and on the whole, that will turn out to be true, and that's an empirical claim. But whether it justifies the idea of collective responsibility, even if it was empirically the case, is quite a jump. Again, there is this kind of interlinking of the empirical and the normative. The argument, again, critics of Hayek, and I count myself amongst these, will also want to say that intention isn't as important as people like Hayek think in terms of understanding our responsibilities, that, as Rawls argues in A Theory of Justice, it's not how something came about that raises questions of justice, but our responses to how things came, to the situation that people are in. We don't determine whether something, a situation is just or unjust, just by how it came about, but it's also about our response to it. Again, I'm not arguing for or against that view, and it's actually quite a weak view, but again, there is that intermingling of both the empirical side and the normative side. And then again, for Rawls, and this is something that comes out very well in Thomas Podge's new book, the link between institutional design and the generation of poverty, we can see that different kinds of institutions are likely to produce more poverty than others, and if we have a responsibility, denied by Hayek, but if we have a responsibility to relieve poverty, then we need to make sure that we avoid these problems of institutional design that actually cause poverty, and that contract is one way of trying to figure out what kinds of institutions would be best placed to deal with those sorts of things. So the question I'm raising here is, given the, it seems to be almost necessary intertwining of normative and empirical issues in this whole debate that I've only obviously sketched out in the simplest sort of way, that given that, how can contractarian theories cope with that complexity of both normative and empirical? And in particular, how, if you like, testable many of the empirical arguments are, for example, about foreseeability, about people's positions in markets from different starting points, and how relevant those sorts of things are. So it's a matter of what goes into the contractual grinder, if you like, that's what I'm getting at, and how far we can think those things through. My own view is we have to think those things through in quite different ways, from contractual ways, that they might then go into the grinder when they've been thought through. But I don't think they can just go in as they are, whether you're a Hayekian on this or a Rawlsian or whatever else. I think similar sorts of issues arise in relation to insurance approaches to the welfare state. Questions that are partly normative and partly empirical. You might say, as a sort of reasonable empirical conjecture, that on an insurance-based approach, some people will not actually be able to pay the costs of the insurance premium, whether it's a private one or a state one. So that immediately raises the question. I'm aware that there are ways of answering this, but it raises the question of, well, doesn't this mean that any insurance system is going to have to be a two-tier system, a sort of good system for those who can pay and a more minimalist system for those who can't? But that also then raises the question, which would be raised by Nozick, well, why? You know, why should they be protected at all if they can't pay? I mean, there is a normative issue there, as well as should citizenship require a one-tier or a two-tier system? I mean, that there's an empirical conjecture about people's behaviour in relation to insurance, coupled with a normative issue about ideas of membership, inclusion, and so forth. So again, we get the same kind of problem. And would an insurance system under which it was reasonably conjectured that many people would end up with the bottom end of a two-tier system, would that be agreed to behind the veil of ignorance and so forth? I mean, aren't the arguments there, particularly if you adopt a Maximin approach, rather similar to Rawls's arguments against average utility on a Maximin view, you might want to be rather wary of those sorts of things. On the other hand, you might say, well, there's no problem because people can nevertheless in an insurance system be credited in if they can't afford to pay. They could be credited in by the state, if it was a state system, to a higher level of provision. But does this mean that we then have, that we credit in everybody who can't pay? And what would be the sort of perverse incentive effects of that? Or does it mean that we credit in only those people who are undertaking approved but nevertheless too lowly remunerated kinds of socially valuable things? And who's going to do the approving, as it were? Again, at the heart of this would be quite a strong conception of the good about what kinds of social goods people are pursuing that allow them to be credited in when they can't be purchasing insurance through their own income, let's say. Again, an odd sort of mixture, a complex mixture of empirical and normative things. There is also an issue here, which I don't want to go into very much because I don't understand quite a lot of the complexities of it, but it applies right through the whole contractarian argument, it seems to me. But, I mean, who is part of the contract? And in particular, in real-life societies, what about migrants and immigrants and so forth, who quite clearly would not have built up insurance at the standard level to produce the benefits that, a 40-year payment into a pension or whatever it might produce. There are going to be massive problems about who is going to be contracted in and on what terms, and whether their contribution is seen as a valued thing, or are we contracting in everybody, or are we contracting in everybody but only to a minimalist kind of system? And how do we distinguish between the minimal and the maximal, as it were? So lots of problems, it seems to me, with the insurance approach. And I've been leafing through the papers this afternoon at the hotel, and obviously there's a lot to be said about that, and I'm sure it will all be taken far further than I'm in a position to just in this general talk this evening. Let's have a look at some of the citizenship approaches, and this will lead me on to thinking much more about the specific form of contract that I mentioned earlier on, about rights and obligations in particular, and how that might be elucidated in contractarian terms. Broadly speaking, and I don't want to dwell on this too much, I spent quite a lot of my life writing about it, but I won't go into it very much because I want to try and get to something in a sense slightly more interesting. But on this sort of approach that I'm looking at, welfare is to be seen either as based on common needs that we recognise as citizens, or that those needs support claims to rights and entitlements and so forth. Now, those are all normative claims of quite a complex sort. I mean, needs is a particularly difficult concept to analyse effectively, and it certainly can't be analysed, I think, without bringing in quite large normative assumptions. So again, something to be thought through in terms of a comprehensive contractarian model. But the issue that this leads to, and that I think brings out this question of empirical and normative in quite an acute way, is the fact that many critics of that, if you like, citizenship rights-based approach to welfare want to make some extremely strong claims, which are quite explicitly a sort of heady mixture of strong normative claims and strong empirical claims, which seem to me to be highly unlikely to be capable of being regarded as part of the Rawlsian general facts about human psychology and general facts about human society. And I want to quote here from Donald Moon, his essay in a book called Democracy and the Welfare State, edited by Amy Gutman. And I quote at some length because I think it is, I think he, you know, he's really onto something here. But it's actually extremely difficult, it seems to me, to handle in terms of any kind of contractarian model. He says, and I have to say he's beating me up here, he says, the entire approach of analysing the welfare state simply in terms of a right to welfare is mistaken. And he wants to say it's mistaken because while rights might be thought to be related to the idea of respect, respecting a person, and that was certainly part of the argument I put forward in the thing that he's criticising, he says that there is a big difference between respect on the one hand and self-respect, and that self-respect, that the whole rights-based argument, which he accepts is based on the idea of respect for persons, is fatally flawed because giving people a right to something that they haven't earned through their own efforts undermines their self-respect. While respect might be a kind of status, self-respect is something we have to achieve, it's something we have to develop. It's developed also in relation to how other people see us and rate our achievements and so forth. And we can only earn self-respect. You can't have self-respect conferred upon you. And self-respect arises from measuring yourself against some kind of standard in Moon's view, and he cites Walzer in this kind of context. He says, it's important not to misunderstand the role of equal respect and equal rights. Equal rights and equal respect have become necessary conditions of self-respect, but they are not sufficient. Self-respect is not a matter of having a certain status or enjoying particular rights. Rather, it requires that one perform certain duties or, better, live up to some ideal. One cannot achieve self-respect simply by having one's rightful claims recognised. Indeed, the opposite Indeed, the opposite may be more nearly true. To be able to assert one's rights depends upon one's having self-respect, that is to say, feeling oneself to be worthy of exercising those rights, and that depends upon one's living up to the standards one holds. To have self-respect, we must be accorded the rights of citizens. To gain self-respect, we must perform the duties of citizens. And that, of course, brings us immediately into the obligation-based view of welfare. Now, again, I don't want to argue the toss with Donald Moon about whether he's right or wrong over this, only just to point out that this is a very complex kind of piece of reasoning in terms of, there must be an empirical case to be deployed here. I mean, is this how self-respect is conceived by people? Measuring up to some kind of standard how people understand self-respect? What sorts of standards? How are these to be approved of in a collective context? Because it's to do with the public realm of welfare and rights and so forth. I mean, what kinds of activities do you have to engage in, as it were, to earn the self-respect that is thought to be absolutely essential here? Well, none of this argument is presented. I mean, it may be available, but it's certainly not presented. But even if it was available, there would still be the kind of Rawlsian types of questions. Is there evidence about, I mean, and remember that self-respect is one of the primary goods for Rawls. So if Moon is correctly elucidating the notion of self-respect, how do these claims fit into the idea of the general facts of human psychology and human society? Are these part of the general facts? And how far are they highly disputable? How do we know, as it were, what goes into the contractarian mill? If it's got to be premises that we all agree on in order to get the contractarian result out, can these sorts of arguments be part of that? Now, it also relates to the point I made earlier about reflexive equilibrium. Are these part of the considered judgments of the society that the contractarian model is trying to sort of systematize and make coherent, as Rawls sees it, using his example of as an exemplar of the contractarian model? So again, it seems to me we've got a real kind of hybrid sort of argument here in Donald Moon's case. I'm not disputing it, only that it is a difficult argument. And is this pre-contractarian? Is this part of the general knowledge that will then go into the contractarian argument? Or what is it? I mean, if you're saying, well, look, we've got these different models of welfare and a comprehensive contractarian view ought to be able to help us to resolve which is the, in some sense, best of the alternatives. What can go into the contract as part of general knowledge about human psychology and general knowledge about human society. And I think the moon argument, while it may be seen as in some sense persuasive, would need a very great deal more elaboration in order to make that clear. Because, I mean, if as he goes on to argue, for example, that the central element of self-respect, the central respect-conferring element, is actually work, then does this mean that those who can't work, you know, the disabled, for example, are somehow cut out from? They can have equal respect, but they can't have self-respect because they can't earn it in the socially sanctioned kind of way. And would you, behind a veil of ignorance, not knowing whether you are going to be disabled and therefore cut off from the central, socially sanctioned way of gaining self-respect, agree to a society in which work was regarded as the socially sanctioned form of self-respect? If you didn't know, it's exactly the Rawlsian kind of problem, that you've got this deep choice to make without knowing whether you're going to be in the disadvantaged group, cut off from what for Rawls, behind the veil of ignorance, is an absolutely central primary good. And then, of course, you might say, well, if you were Donald Moon, because he does say work can be provided. I mean, we can get more and more people into work. And perhaps it's the job of the state to go some way to ensuring that through either enabling programs like mentoring and so forth and help. And a lot of this goes on now, particularly with disabled people. But the issue then is, and this is very well argued by Elster in an essay in the same volume, that to be given a job by the state or to be put into a job by the state does no more to increase your self-respect than does having a kind of being the passive recipient of a benefit, because you haven't earned it. If the crucial thing is you only get self-respect by developing something and earning it, then being, as it were, guaranteed some kind of job by the state as the employer of last resort or whatever it might be, that those things won't, in fact, encourage self-respect. There are problems here about... And again, though that surely is in some sense an empirical question about how people feel about, or what their perceptions are about people who are working but at make-work types of jobs, because work is the guarantee of self-respect. But I think there are big questions, both of informational questions behind a veil of ignorance in a contract, but also questions about what sort of information would be available behind the veil of ignorance, and how people would then choose if they don't have access to one of the bases of self-respect, because access to it in a labour market is going to be a highly contingent thing. So we get this dilemma that self-respect depends upon work, work depends on the labour market is, fairly random and unpredictable, we can't guarantee anything. If we could guarantee anything, you wouldn't get self-respect anyway because you hadn't earned it. So there is a problem there, it seems to me. And that's one of the very specific examples of what you might call the narrower issue of contract, of getting a benefit through discharging an obligation, which may in turn be justified by a more comprehensive view of contract. But I think we need a lot more information about what goes into the contract. I could say a bit about Hayek on welfare and the rule of law, but I don't think I will, because it would be very much the same kind of thing, that arguments that the welfare state is incompatible with the rule of law because it entrenches discretionary power by bureaucracies and so forth. I think you can parallel that by arguments about all sorts of other things that the state does that would, on the same basis, be equally incompatible with the rule of law because they entrench bureaucratic power at the heart of the state provision of services that we can't do without, for example, like the police force and so forth. So I won't go into that, but it's the same kind of issue. So just to finish then, I'm sorry to have taken so long, but it seems to me that there are two different sort of understandings of contract, both contract in the sense of providing a mechanism for justifying one as opposed to another conception of the welfare state, and then contract as elucidating a relationship between sort of entitlement and obligation within a welfare state. It seems to me that because we have these different models that I've outlined in the barest form, and there are many others as well, but given that we've got these different models, unless a contractarian approach can somehow provide a way of arbitrating between those models or providing us with very good reasons for choosing one rather than another, and I know there are advocates in the papers, in the deck of papers that we've all got, who will argue that it can. But I mean, you know, the proof of the pudding is going to be in the eating over the next couple of days as to whether the contractarian model can in fact enable us to make considered judgments in favour of one rather than the other. And I think the crucial thing there is the kind of information that has to be taken as given, as something that is not itself part of the contract, but the contract has to draw upon. And partly this will be normative information, if that's not quite an odd way of putting it, but it will also be empirical information, in my view, of pretty disputed sort. And it will also be predominantly hybrid information, that empirical material with very strong normative implications built into it. And my own view is that it's actually quite difficult to see how a comprehensive contractual view can actually solve these problems. I think it can elucidate some of the issues, and I think it may well be useful to think about contract in the much more specific sense of the relationship between benefits and obligations and so forth. But I'm rather sceptical, I have to say, of the use of comprehensive contract as a way of trying to resolve the choice between fundamental and equally fundamentally different views of what the welfare state should or shouldn't be doing. Okay.